Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
You're very welcome back. No score still between Iran and Spain. 34 minutes on the clock. On the line, we have Ewan McKenna, whose work you'll read in the Irish Independent, amongst other places. And we have Matt Slater as well, chief sports reporter with the Press Association, both on the line. I suppose we're talking about the general number of eyebrows raised in the direction of Russia over the last number of days. Matt, before we get into that, I understand you've just had the pleasure of trying to doorstep Sepp Blatter and Vitaly Mutko, the former Russian sports minister. Two fine fellows. How did that go for you?
Yes, that is true. How are you? I doorstepped them. I went to their very fancy hotel, Sepp Blatter's very fancy hotel. He, of course, has been invited to Russia 2018 by Vladimir Putin. A tough man to say no to, I suppose. Controversial for many reasons. One being that Sepp Blatter is supposed to be banned from all football activities. I suppose you can't stop a man buying a ticket and going to a game. But I was slightly surprised to see Vitaly Mutko, who's possibly the only man in Moscow more controversial than Putin. Well, actually, that's probably not true. But as controversial as Sepp Blatter anyway, taking him out for dinner. Those were stepping out this evening in Moscow. And waiting for them outside was Alexei Sorokin, who is the chief executive of Russia 2018 and is a FIFA councillor. Now, okay, should Alexei Sorokin be hanging out with Sepp Blatter? I don't know. I having dinner. It's not football activities, but to be a fly on the wall of that one. Mutko, of course, was prevented from going to the Winter Olympics, belatedly, some might say, for very probably running Russia's state-sponsored doping program. And I'm not quite sure to where to start with Sepp Blatter's charge sheet. But anyway, look, they've gone out into the Moscow evening, and I hope to talk to Sepp Blatter properly tomorrow morning.
And did they seem pleased to see you, Matt?
Not really, no. To be fair, Sepp is in a really good mood. I mean, he's been posing for selfies for the last 24 hours and said, I'll talk to you tomorrow morning. But Tony Mutko was less pleased to see me, and a sort of large, burly man came between me and them pretty soon, and I was sort of kept at the door as they went out to get in their limo. But it wasn't overly aggressive. I'm sure if I tried to talk to a British or Irish deputy prime minister like that, I'd have got similar treatment.
Yeah, what's Mutko's current role in Russian life?
Well, he is the deputy prime minister.
Okay.
And he's still the president of the Russian Football Union, which again is I'm not quite sure how that one's been allowed to slide.
Yeah, how has he survived that one so well? I just presumed he was just hanging around for a while.
No, well, yeah, I think a lot of people are making the same assumption that FIFA are going to sort of eventually tackle, if that's the right word, the state-sponsored doping issue, Mutko, for example, after Russia 2018. You know, everything's been, let's not embarrass the Russians, let's not shake things up too much. We will deal with this once the tournament's out of the way. And to be fair, Mutko has stepped down from the FIFA Council and Sorokin's slid in, and he also stepped down from an explicit role with Russia 2018, although it's quite clear that he's still pulling the strings.
It is laughable, really, that Sepp Blatter is around this World Cup, given he's been banned for life from all football activities. Are we anticipating any response from FIFA? No doubt there'll have been many requests for comment.
No, well, many. Look, the official line is we're not commenting, and I don't blame them. They don't want to embarrass anyone really. They don't really want to talk about this. I know they were watching very, very closely because Blatter went to the game. He went to the same game I was at, Portugal Morocco. He was in a better seat than me, no doubt. And it was very, very interesting that there were no photographs of him, despite everyone trying to get him. Now, I think that was done very intentionally. He was presumably, buried at the back of a box with heavily tinted windows. And I think that was, he can go to the game, just do not be caught on camera at that game. Mm-hmm. So we understand he's going to go to St. Petersburg tomorrow, where my schedule's all over the place. I think Brazil might be playing. And then he'll go home. He'll go back to Switzerland. So he's here on a sort of, you know, whistle stop, you know, here's what you could have won type tour, because, of course, this was his idea. Well, not necessarily his idea, but he wanted this to happen, and it happened. Mm. You know, that infamous vote back in December 2010, he didn't want Qatar to happen, and that brought the whole house down. He knew it would, and it did. But he wanted Russia 2018 to happen, and he actually had this grandiose idea that Russia 2018, USA 2022 would win him a Nobel Prize.
Let's talk about Russia, which was very much your intention before you doorstep Sepp and Vitaly just trying to have a quiet dinner. So you, and I know you were probably part of those generally raising an eyebrow and more, besides watching Russia's 5-0, 3-1 wins over Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Like, in bare figures, the distances covered have been used certainly as almost a smoking gun, if not quite. So what are we looking at when we're talking distances covered and how it ranks across round one of the tournament?
The Russians are number one and two, 118 kilometres covered against Saudi Arabia, 116 against Egypt last night. Just as a rough comparison, if you take the Champions League final, I think Liverpool covered 110 and Real Madrid 102. But part of me even is slightly reticent to point the finger at Russia based on Saudi Arabia and Egypt, or even look at their form coming into this World Cup, because as hosts, a lot of their friendlies were against very, very strong nations. Plus, for example, Egypt in Ramadan, I know Saudi Arabia had special dispensation. Egypt decided not to go with that. So you're obviously going to get this difference. They are hosts. And it's not like there hasn't been enough to point the finger at Russia before this tournament.
Yeah.
Or in the last. I mean, if you want to look at Russia's lead up to this, and bring in Vitaly Mutko and bring in Dr. Grigory Rodchenko, the former head of their doping agency. This goes back to 2014. And what we have, we've had a state-sponsored doping regime around the Sochi Winter Olympics because Putin wanted to employ soft power, come top of the medals table, all this. And I don't know why anyone would expect him to do anything different around this, especially as Russian Winter Olympians are probably better naturally than the state of their soccer team is at the minute. But if you go back to before that World Cup and you look at Grigory Rodchenko, the former head of their anti-doping agency, who's been the whistleblower, he's the guy you'll see popping up, as you know, Joe, in a balaclava in witness protection in America, because he's changed his appearance, and for good reason, because shortly before he blew the whistle, two of his former colleagues, Nikita Kameyev and Yevachislav Sinev, showed up dead in mysterious circumstances. And before the last World Cup, he released emails since that showed this thing of exit controls for the Russian team that went to Brazil. And Rodchenko was being asked by the state if they were healthy, which he said was code for basically a cover-up that they could pass doping tests. He's also said, and Matt mentioned Vitaly Mutko, he's trying to a doorstep, a brave man. I mean, he's also said that Mutko gave him the order that we don't get positives in football, were his exact words. So this blew up after the last World Cup, and the lab, the WADA lab in Moscow, was shown up as dirty. But that didn't stop them doing tests and continuing on with their dirt, as we've seen, because in summer 2015, I'll give you one example, Ruslan Kambalov, the defender for Rubin Kazan, who was in the World Cup squad before he got injured. His test came up, and his name has only been released in recent days. He was taking corticosteroid tablets, which in competition are against the WADA, they're on the WADA banned list. He claimed he took them 3 weeks earlier, which is impossible because this sample has since been run by a German lab and it shows that it takes 24 hours basically to get out of your system, yet his sample was 15 to 20 times above the suspicious limit. Rodchenkov's diary around that time, that was June 10, 2015, and he brings in Yevgeny Blokhin, if you bear with me here, who was the FSB, the Russian political police, came to the lab. He's also the guy who organised all the urine swaps around the Sochi games to get athletes off. And according to the diary excerpts, he said that Blokhin showed up with his magicians and performed four tricks. Thank God everything went well. And he also, that they're basically, again, code words. And he also says Kambalov was classified as a doping case. FIFA knows that. So now we FIFA brought into this. Now, do you think Radchenkov lied? Because he hasn't been shown to lie in the past. Mm-hmm. If he's saying FIFA knew this, what did they do about it? We know now Russian state intelligence, again through this story, they were opening samples of footballers, manipulating samples, exchanging samples. FIFA are now involved in this. And UEFA around Kambalov at that time as well, they said the player bore no fault because the substance was an injection from earlier in the season. So now UEFA are involved, and this doesn't add up according to German scientists. And at the end of 2014, Joe, WADA took a load of samples out of that lab, and 155 footballers were on that list to be tested. Some of those players are believed to have been the World Cup squad we're seeing now. And Dick Pound said in 2017, the former head of WADA, he said it's incumbent on FIFA to say what steps they are taking, what they find, and take whatever action necessary to protect the integrity of the sport. Yet when ADR, the German agency who have investigated this so well, they went to FIFA, and FIFA turned around and said, well, actually, WADA are responsible to explain what we did with those samples. So they went to WADA, who said FIFA are responsible for what they did with those samples. It does not add up. And as I said, this is why I'm kind of reticent to make it about the results of Saudi Arabia or Egypt.
You are, because the distance is covered. I mean, like I said, a smoking gun of sorts, and it can be used that way. But really, Christian Eriksen was 0.5 of a kilometre behind the number one in terms of distance covered. Golovin, the Russian player, the young midfielder, he hit 12.7. Christian Eriksen, 12.2. You know, I was of a mind that very famously in that game against Greece where David Beckham scored the free kick which got England to the O2 World Cup at Old Trafford, Beckham in that game covered 16.1 kilometres. So these distances that Russia have covered in the first two games are very impressive, but they're not completely impossible. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that a home nation inspired by a country and the adrenaline that goes with it might perform this way. And I guess you got to see how a tournament might unfold, especially if the distances went off a cliff, which is entirely feasible. So I agree. I don't think what we've seen in the first two rounds has had our jaws hitting the floor, Matt. It is more the broader picture which Ewan has begun to try and paint. And it is a complicated picture, but it's more about that than what we've seen in the opening two rounds, I think.
No, absolutely. I'm not going to disagree with a word of what Ewan said there. I mean, I think you're right, though, just again, in the spirit of fairness, to point out that we have seen these distances before. As you say, they're the home side. They came in under a massive cloud. I mean, no one here thought they'd do anything at all. And, you know, speaking to Russian fans before, they were really, they quite low about the team. I mean, they were the lowest ranked host nation ever. I think they were 71st when they took on, or 70th perhaps when they took on, when they played Saudi Arabia. I was at that game. It was actually 70th versus 67th, you know, so it wasn't a particularly stellar cast. And look, to be fair, you know, Saudi were appalling. Russia weren't. Russia were good. They were good again yesterday. And the mood here in Russia is buoyant. It really is. I've just walked through Red Square, and you know, the party's continuing. It's all over the media. You know, I did actually manage to get a nod out of Mutko that he's enjoying the tournament. So yes, they're inspired. Yes, they are an awful lot of expectation. They are performing above expectation. I saw those running stats and I just thought, this is brilliant. You can't write this. This is fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, we've just had this amazing 2-3 year story about state-sponsored doping. And, you know, the joke really around, you know, the football team was, well, if they're doping, my word, I mean, you know, it's not working, is it? Because they're hopeless. Mm. Well, you know, they're not hopeless at the moment.
No, they're not. Radchenkov, and I presume you probably watched some of it at that conference in May, where he did appear with the balaclava as well, the Sport, Politics and Integrity conference in May. So he was saying he had looked through the names of the players involved in the Russian squad, and he said he could only find one name that struck him as having been involved in the programme, and that's that defender, Kambalov, who you mentioned. So what FIFA have said, by the way, is that all the tests from this World Cup will be sealed and taken straight to Switzerland. Like, Radchenkov has basically said here that this World Cup will be clean in terms of this 1 month of competition in Russia. But as we know, Ewan, that doesn't count for very much.
Well, no, I mean, between microdosing and what you can do without being caught, And B, what you can get away with within these major sporting organizations. They say a lot of things. And the big question is, why would they sabotage their brand? And that goes for, be it the World Tennis Federation, be it for the IAAF and athletics, be it for FIFA. It doesn't make sense to kind of hurt your own brand by showing this up. With Rodchenkov, yeah, he was gone in 2015, but I suppose the question is, does that stop then? And even with Russia's links, I mean, how much can they get away with? The International Olympic Committee banned Russia because they admitted to this state-sponsored doping. Yes, FIFA didn't want to throw Russia out of their own World Cup, which they would have had to done under their own laws if they admitted the same thing. And as Matt said, it's something they might look into afterwards. But the political links are bothersome as well, I suppose. Ken Bensinger has a new book called Red Card out about kind of the Russian state and their involvement in various areas. And he brings up how Vitaly Mutko basically said all available sources will be given to trying to block the FBI investigation into FIFA. He said that to Eugenio Fuenuarda. I think he was the Uruguayan vice president. He said it to his lawyer, and he said he could tell him about some specific strategies the state would use, but not others. So it does go very deep, and people get skeptical when you go this deep into stuff, and they think sport is just sport, and come on, let's get serious about it. But I mean, even talking to people about how this World Cup ended up in Russia, not that there's anything wrong with it, but the deals that were pulled, be it through the Russian mafia laundering art, which ended up with Michel Doug in Belgium. They talk about the Nord Stream gas pipeline into Germany and how Angela Merkel is desperate for this and Franz Beckenbauer was instructed to do this. And then even stuff that's on the record, like the Qatar World Cup next time around, Michel Platini was instructed by Nicolas Sarkozy to vote for Qatar because they might buy more Airbus A380s. Mm-hmm. So people might be skeptical about this at first, but the links go so deep because sport is such a powerful tool, and what Putin can do this month is, at a time when he was supposed to be frozen out of the world picture, not only is he center stage, but he can control the narrative as well, which is a very powerful weapon.
Yeah, and I think people have a right to be skeptical about all this stuff for sure, and want to believe that things aren't quite as bad as they appear, but I guess ask themselves, even if 15 or 20% of what you're alleging is vaguely true, and I think people will accept it's entirely possible as well. There are not many quicker ways to transfer all this public money into private hands as quickly as sport and hosting these events. The thing we should state is the McLaren report, the Richard McLaren report. So that was 2016 when this thing really blew up and we were really beginning to get into what was going on in Sochi and Russia generally. He absolutely said football was among the 30 sports involved, Matt. Now, FIFA did come out and say that it found insufficient, was their word, evidence of doping amongst Russian footballers. And that was a couple of months ago. ARD, who do brilliant work, the German television station, Hauhaus Seppelt's station, they've said absolutely, they've claimed that the samples of the Russian 2018 World Cup squad were not properly investigated. Like, you know, we're in this horrible stage where we just kind of shrug our shoulders at that. That's not a surprising thing, but that is the architecture around this World Cup. ARD are saying absolutely that the Russian squad's tests, which Richard McLaren pointed towards, well, he pointed towards Russian football, if not necessarily the squad, but ARD are saying they weren't properly investigated. I mean, there's just a general acceptance now, I think, amongst the sporting fan population that this is what happens.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's very, very sad. We are, I think, perpetually now stuck in this horrible grey area. I mean, just to go back on some of the things that Ewan was saying, and I think this is really fundamental. After the McLaren report, well, sort of, we had a couple of McLaren reports.
Say again, Matt, we lost you there. Say again.
Well, the initial one, so RASADA, which is the Russian anti-doping agency, have been basically effective. They've been suspended. They're non-compliant with WADA's rules. And everyone was desperate to sort of turn that around because they knew that this was this enormous, major, major event. And not to have a compliant working anti-doping agency for a major sporting event like this was unfathomable. But look, here we are. We you know, they have been unwilling or unable to meet the roadmap for reinstatement that was agreed 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the two key points, they've done all the cosmetic stuff. UK Anti-Doping Agency have been helping them out. World Anti-Doping Agency have bent over backwards. They put money in. They've done all the sort of obvious stuff.
Yeah.
The two things they haven't done, one is to allow international access to the hundreds of frozen samples they still have in Moscow. Mm-hmm. I'm led to believe that there's not much in there. But the irony here, and this is almost another one of these sick jokes, the Russians aren't allowing access to those samples because they're not quite sure of that. They don't really know what they've got. Mm. I understand that Rodchenkov has sort of said, don't worry about it, they've already swapped all the good stuff. So, but they are not letting international access to their lab. And most importantly, and this is, again, I think, tied up with all the stuff I was saying at the beginning about embarrassment and this being Putin's moment, they have to publicly accept the findings of those reports. Now, these are reports that haven't just been corroborated now twice by the World Anti-Doping Agency. They've been corroborated by two IOC, International Olympic Committee commissions, and they had to be dragged. Trust me, they had to be dragged to that position. Mm. So it's been to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. These are now proven facts. The Russians are refusing to publicly accept those findings, because that would mean, yes, we ran a state-sponsored East German-style doping program, and that massively puts this right back at Mutko's door, the man on his doorstep. Yeah. And of course, who does he report to? Who's his line manager? It's Putin. It's the man that spent 5 minutes at the first game, the opening ceremony, telling us how much Russia loves football, welcoming us here, reminding us what a massive event this was. Of course it's a massive event, Vlad. It's your event. You're getting it. You've got this wonderful opportunity now to change the narrative, which has been nerve agent attacks in pizzerias in Salisbury. It's been Syria. It's been invading Crimea. The next month, he gets to be mine host. It's a remarkable backdrop to this event. And, you know, it's quite depressing. However, the sun is out and the football's decent. So, I'm conflicted as well.
A very last question then, Ewan, tied-ish for time. Russia are a whole different level of crazy. You know, like, they stand alone in many respects, just the extent of the state-sponsored doping and the number of reports and effectively the amount of evidence we have, and obviously the quality of Rodchenkov as a whistleblower. So separating Russia from this World Cup for a second, like, number two on the running charts for the opening round is Christian Eriksen at 12.2 kilometres. And he's consistently in the top one or two, actually, somewhat surprisingly, across the Premier League season. Now, based on not much more than my feel for the guy, I don't think Eriksen is doping. He never has caused alarm for me whatsoever. So I'm not overly reliant on some of that data in the same way that you might be for something like cycling, where Froome does something heroic or amazing in a mountain stage. So how confident are we in the vast majority of teams at this World Cup?
It's a hard one, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I'm always wary of people turning around and saying, oh, look, you're just calling Russia this and Russia that, Russia's as if it's the typical West narrative. And it's the typical West narrative, the kind of 1980s even Drago narrative of the big bad communist country at the time. Look, they're not the only ones. I mean, if you want to go back to Operation Puerto in Spain, where the Spanish government stopped people looking into blood bags, where journalists brought up big Spanish football clubs, where a lot of people would have had to have lied and risked their own careers for no particular reason, for those stories to be true. And I mean, look, football has always been at it.
No, I know, go back, but I'm asking about 2018. And you're allowed to say, look, I don't know, because I don't. But look, we can go back to Juventus, we can go back to the Italian clubs down the years, we can go back to the Germans back in the day. It's definitely happened, no question. Football's as grubby a business as plenty. What about 2018, though? What do you think?
Well, logic would say it's human nature still, as it always was, and there's more at stake and the rewards are greater now than they ever were. Mm. FIFA may be more compromised than ever, and the chemistry is more ahead of the anti-doping than perhaps it's been since the 1970s. When you take all those things into account, it would be illogical, put it that way, to say that it isn't happening far beyond one country or far beyond one team. I mean, I don't think it's a surprise. If the history of football, you look at the present, it would make sense for it to be happening.
Yeah. Matt, last word to you very quickly. To what extent is the question? I think we all agree with you in that it most likely is happening. Just basic logic would suggest so. But to what extent is the really interesting question with football right now?
Well, it's impossible to say, isn't it? I really wouldn't want to speculate. I'm not, comfortable doing that. I think Ewan and you have outlined it quite nicely. I mean, what I would say is I've often felt with the big organized team sports, particularly from football and rugby, my real concern would be around pain management. I think some corners are being cut there. I think some avant-garde treatments are being used. And it's about getting players on the pitch, keeping them on the pitch, keeping them fit and healthy. That's where most of my suspicions lie, okay, with football in particular.
Gents, we'll leave it there. Matt, happy doorstepping over in Russia. Thank you for joining us. And you and McKenna, as ever, pleasure. Thanks, fellas. Short break.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Not the most convincing performance from Spain that we'll see at this World Cup, but they have squeezed past Iran, which can be tricky at the best of times. Diego Costa with his third of the tournament, 1-0 winners, like Portugal were this afternoon as well against Morocco. Ronaldo with his 85th goal of his international career. He continues to be something of a phenomenon. And that's kind of, in short, the general story of the World Cup on day seven. Day seven, where's it all going? So we'll have Rafael Honigstein with us later on. Germany, if they were to lose to Sweden, which on the face of it still does seem unlikely despite how poor they were against Mexico, it would be the earliest exit for the Germans since the 1938 World Cup, and they have had a crisis meeting, classic crisis meeting for the Germans this week, and according to Manuel Neuer, it was the strongest words we have ever had within this team. So Rafael Honigstein will fill us in. But before we do all that, France, after their win against Australia, and flattering to deceive, are back in action tomorrow. So we want to check in on the French camp. They play Peru. It's at 4 o'clock Irish time. The general word is they could well name unchanged 11s, both sides, but France included, despite Giroud no doubt pushing for a start. To discuss everything going on with the French at the moment, we have Julien Lorraine with us. Hello, Julien.
Hello, guys.
Where in the world are you at the moment?
I'm in Moscow. It's it's 11:15 for me at night. I need to go to bed soon.
Oh, okay. And how is Moscow?
Sorry?
How is Moscow?
Yeah, it's great. I have to say, people have been very, very welcoming. The city is great. It's wonderful. It's really big. So when you want to go from one part to another, it takes quite a while, but the tube is great. There's not so much traffic when you're in a cab, or when we have shuttle buses as well that takes us from the hotel to the stadiums and things like that. It's been really cool. The only little thing I would say is that they haven't put many internal flights. When you want to travel from, say St. Petersburg to Kazan, like I did, for example, you have to go via Moscow, and the flights are a bit tricky with time really early usually. So, but that's the only little thing. If really you want to be picky, apart from that, it's been great, I have to say.
Okay. You know, it's a small thing. You're not the first, or I suspect last person, to mention the quality of the Moscow metro to us. So what are we talking about here? I mean, the metro in Paris strikes me as pretty good. Does it beat that?
Oh, yeah, man. Tonight, for example, I was coming back. So I went to Morocco, Portugal, at the Luzhniki Stadium. And then on my way back on the tube, they actually had TVs showing the Spain match against Iran. So you're sat on the tube going home or going back to your hotel, whatever, and you're actually watching the live game in like pure HD, HD screen, whatever you want. It was not bugging, it was not lagging, it was just perfect. And I was like, I almost missed my stop because I was just watching the match. It was awesome. So, they've got Wi-Fi, but it's beautifully done. There's so often that, I have to say, the Moscow metro is something else.
Okay, interesting. So let's talk France then. You had a quote that France did win against Australia, but Deschamps lost.
Yeah, that's the feeling, really. He got everything wrong, pretty much. The only positive thing he did was to bring Giroud on with 20 minutes to go, and he had a very positive impact. You know, he set up the goal for Pogba, or the Australian home goal. And I thought it was good. That's why he's going to start tomorrow. But apart from that, I think Deschamps got everything wrong, from his formation to the tactics to the players he picked. I think it was a horror show from him. It was a horror show from France. They got really, really lucky to get the 3 points. And I guess that's the only thing, we will remember from that game is that they got the 3 points, and that on that level, at least, it was a positive start. But for everything else, it was just not good enough.
Okay, wow, okay. Well, look, everything wrong is a fairly big statement. So let's give some examples. What could he have done different? And maybe what has he done differently in the past? Is this very different, France, to what we saw from Deschamps in the qualifying?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I think is that he's been playing, you know, against you boys, against Ireland since the halftime of that last 16 at the Euros in Lyon, where he switched from the 4-3-3 to a 4-4-2 formation, like a pure 4-4-2, four flat in midfield and two up front, Griezmann and Giroud, which got France to the European Championship final. They should have won, in my opinion. They didn't. And since then, he's been always playing with that 4-4-2 that, you know, worked really well, although the team in itself hasn't really improved, hasn't really built on that very quite successful European Championship. And then suddenly, a month before the start of the World Cup, he decides that 4-4-2 is just not good enough anymore. He changes everything. He has three friendly matches in which he always played the same formation, which is a 4-3-1-2, with, in the first game against Ireland, Fekir as a number 10, behind Giroud and Mbappé. Then he plays Griezmann as a number 10, behind Giroud and Mbappé in the last game before we fly over to Russia. So everybody thinks, okay, they've worked on that for 3 weeks. That's how he's going to play. You know, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, we didn't really care so much. Whether it was going to work or not, it was the thing was, they worked on this. That's what he wanted. The players were expecting it. Everybody else was expecting it. And then 2 days before the game against Australia, he decides to change again and go to a 4-3-3 with, like, you know, Conte, Tolisso and Pogba in midfield, and then Griezmann wide with Mbappe and Dembele, and those three changing positions the whole time. So sometimes you had Griezmann in the center, then right, then left, and then Dembele in the center, then left, then right, same for Mbappe. And it was just a complete mess. It was a real mess. The players didn't like it. They didn't understand what he wanted them to do. They didn't know if they had to press high, to drop deep. They had quite a heated team meeting on Monday at the camp here in Moscow, where the players basically told Deschamps that we had no instructions. You know, we don't know what to do. So the mood is not the greatest. And I think, you know, I think in his team selection, he picked 7 players out of 11 who never played a World Cup match before. And I think that's far too much, because as we saw, the pressure gets to you, the tension gets to you, the expectation, even for someone, let's say, like Tolisso, who has done really well with France so far, who is one of the, you know, not the most arrogant, but he has that sort of ultra super confidence.
Yeah, he's French.
On him. And even him, he couldn't play his own game. He couldn't be free. He really struggled with the pressure. And I think that, you know, that was too much to have 7 out of 11 who never played in a World Cup, instead of having Giroud and Matuidi there, for example, to balance it a bit more. He went for too much youth, too much inexperience, and I think that cost us as well.
Okay, so I accept what you're saying then. That does sound like a real horror show from Deschamps. Hey, very interesting that they'd have that meeting on Monday and the players are not shy in telling Deschamps that they think he didn't give them enough instruction and effectively got it wrong. I didn't realise they had that relationship. Deschamps didn't strike me as somebody who would take criticism too regularly.
No, but I think he realised there had been a problem. Mm. They were so bad. And yeah. I promise you, it was probably even worse for us in the stadium than for you on television. It was so bad. Mm. There was just nothing, apart from the first 15 minutes where, you know, Mbappé has that first chance very early on Pavard ball through. By the way, the ball is not for Mbappé at all at that time. It's a ball for Griezmann that he overhits and that he ends up in the box for Mbappé. And then Griezmann has a half volley. There's a couple of things, but after that, it was literally dire. It was really that bad. And yeah. I think Deschamps realised, okay, something was really wrong. And I think the players, I mean, I saw Lloris after the game, and he said, and Lloris is usually very good in that, especially he had a great save, so, you know, he felt a bit buoyant in, like, he did his job and yeah. the rest of the team didn't. And he was like, you know, we have to be all on the same page. We went on the same page today. We have to be 11 players on the same page. That would make life far easier for us than what we were today, because he said sometimes some were pressing, the others didn't. Sometimes some dropped deep, the others didn't. When we had the ball, there was no movement, or people were doing the same run. It was just a shambles. It was really shambolic. Like, to a point that I've hardly seen one of Deschamps' French team like that, in that much of a shambles. So I think think Deschamps realized that's why he called up that meeting. That's why he took the criticism fairly well.
Yeah.
That's why I think the players spoke up as well, because they knew something was wrong and you couldn't continue like this. So we hope that tomorrow there's a bit of a reaction from the players and from him in his plan and in his tactics. Although I'm not seeing how he's going to do tomorrow, I'm not so sure he got the message.
Right. And I mentioned at the outset, well, it was certainly based on the reports I'd seen, that they could well name the same 11 that started on Saturday. Are you expecting the same 11 then?
No, my friend, I don't know which reports you're reading. Not mine, because I wrote yesterday, same in L'Equipe, same in Le Parisien, that he's going to make at least two changes. Well, we expect just two changes in Giroud and Matuidi, which is completely normal. Them coming back in the team for Tolisso and Dembele, who were really poor against Australia. The weird thing, again, is it's another formation. This time he's going to play in a 4-4-2, but with Matuidi as a sort of left wide player, left winger, if you want.
Yeah.
Which is a bit weird. From what we've been told, he's a bit scared of Andre Carrillo. Yeah, the Carrillo from Watford, who scored one goal and has two assists in the Premier League season. So he wants to like make that left-hand side for France quite solid with Lucas Hernandez and Matuidi. Don't get me started, because it makes absolutely no sense to me that we are so scared of Peru, that who lost the first game, by the way, and when we won ours, we're so scared that we put Matuidi to double up on the left-hand side with the left-back just to make us more solid defensively, which will leave basically Giroud, Griezmann and Mbappe to attack pretty much by themselves, because Pogba and Kante will surely be instructed by Deschamps to not go forward too much, because you don't want to leave your back four too exposed. And then Matuidi on the left, he's not a left winger, he's not a left attacking player anyway. So yeah, he can run, can make runs towards the box, but that's not his natural game. So I'm not sure how that's going to pan out. But again, already, I don't have a good feeling about it.
Okay, interesting. A slightly different point. The Antoine Griezmann video certainly drew general derision everywhere. Do we know, we may not, what was made of it within the French camp? Did it appeal to their more artistic sensibilities?
Some of the players said, like, yeah, it made them laugh. A lot of them didn't know that it was doing that. Even on the day, even in the evening, Deschamps didn't know.
Wow.
And Deschamps said, listen, I wanted it sorted before the start of the World Cup, as in like our first game, which he did. Deschamps never said it. I wouldn't be surprised if Deschamps wasn't so keen about it, because that's not his style. That's not usually the thing that he likes. The problem I have with it, and you know, everything has been said, everything has been written, I personally slaughtered Griezmann, you know, saying that he wanted to copy LeBron James, which just that for me is ridiculous enough. But it's even more cynical than that, because Griezmann came to do his press conference in the French camp base on the Tuesday, knowing already then, obviously, that on the Thursday night, the whole comedy will happen.
Yeah.
And he came on purpose, because usually he never comes. He never does a press conference.
Right.
So when we were given his name, everybody thought, okay, he's coming because he's going to announce what he's doing. But he was so cynical that he came on purpose to actually say, no, I'm not going to say it. You will know soon. Just for people to talk about it again for 2 days until he released that video. And I thought that was really poor from him, more than the video in itself, more than everything else. I think the cynic in him to do that thing and come on Tuesday where everybody, and he knew it, he knew that we were there thinking he was going to announce it. And then for him to say, no, I've made my mind up, but I won't tell you now, you will know soon, blah, 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 just to get it pumped up a bit before his video announcement, I thought was really, really poor.
And was the video out of keeping with Griezmann's character? Is he somebody that seeks the limelight? In that sense, was it entirely predictable that he would do something kind of outlandish like this? What type of personality is he?
No, he's not like that. I mean, he's becoming a bit, I have to say, he, you know, with all the success and everything, I think we've seen a few things. I mean, I don't know if you remember the Harlem Globetrotters dressing up scandal when he, you know, he went to a dressing up party and you know, put black face on with the Harlem Globetrotters basketball jersey and shorts and everything.
Mm.
And obviously he got done for that as well. So there's been a few things where I thought, are you not thinking before doing stuff? Are you not just like, who is advising you to do those things? Or who says, yeah, yeah, go on, do those things? Because that video was ridiculous. The outfit was ridiculous. There's been a few things like this where you're thinking, oh, man, come on. Mm. That's not you. Surely that's not Griezmann. So I think that's maybe where, you know, the marketing team around you gets it wrong, but still convince you to do something that is not in your interest. I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe because he loves NBA so much and basketball so much and LeBron so much, he thought that was a good idea to do what LeBron did. But Antoine Griezmann is not LeBron James. He will never be LeBron James. So, yeah, I thought it was a faux pas from him, I have to say.
Yeah. Hey, we've gone 15 minutes talking about France without mentioning Paul Pogba, which I think is probably some kind of record.
Yeah, probably. You're right. What else could we say?
Mm. Well, he says he's the most criticised footballer on the planet. So clearly he's hearing the constant talk about him. I mean, he was involved in the two key moments for France on Saturday. How was his performance received?
Yeah, he did that well. Because he did it well, because he played quick. Which, you know, Deschamps has been on his case the whole time about simplifying his game, not trying too many, like, you know, skills and stuff, but just make what's essential, basically. And he did that very well on the goal. I think those 2-1-2s are what Paul Pogba is all about. You know, the first one with Mbappe, the second one with Giroud, his movement, the quality as well, technically. The ball through for Griezmann is inch perfect as well from 50 yards. And there was a few good things in the first half as well, but he couldn't have done it by himself in that game. And there were times where he was too much by himself. And when you don't get any help from Mbappe or Dembele or Griezmann, it's hard, even if you're Paul Pogba. But yeah. I think his mindset is positive, which I liked. He stopped to speak to us in the mix zone after the game, which again I think was a positive point. And he was quite open, and he was saying we have to do better. I think that was not good enough. He will be disappointed that FIFA took away the goal from him, but I think we need him to be in a positive state of mind, not in a state of mind where he's on the defensive.
Yeah,
if you see what I mean. So on that level, I think he's good. Tomorrow it's a huge game because Peru are good on the ball, but they're also physical. So it's a game, it's the kind of game that he doesn't like, where he might have to run after the ball a lot because they might have the ball a lot. And also when he's on the ball, they might rough him up a bit, which he doesn't like. So it'd be interesting to see how he does tomorrow.
Mm. Hey, before you go, tell us about Grégory Dupont and his 14-page document.
I knew you would love this story. It's good. I like the guy. You know, for a long time, France didn't have a proper fitness coach. He was he was Deschamps' assistant. Guy Stéphane, who was doing the sort of fitness work and things like that. And sometimes they had like some guys who were just coming just before World Cup, for example. But we didn't have someone like full-time focus, etc. Dupont came over and he has good ideas. You know, the water they drink has to be a certain temperature, depending on how warm it is, you know, outside. Mm. He's in terms of his, you know, of the food they're eating. Again, it's all nicely written, depending if you need energy or depending on what kind of food you need, according to the stats they have after training and things like that. So, yeah, he's putting something good in place. The line they have, which I'm curious to have your opinion, is that they're saying that all the fitness work they've done so far is to get this team I speak physically for the last 16 games.
I buy that.
So, you know, so against the US, for example, in the last friendly match before coming over here, they had heavy legs. Against Australia, again, they had heavy legs, which is normal because of all the hard work they did physically. And Deschamps says that the smaller teams, you know, do the preparation and the fitness work to be ready for that first group stage game. That's the difference. But because France have high hopes to go far, they can't do that. So they need to prepare the players for the last 16, which I'm a bit skeptical about it, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But, you know, that's what Dupont's been working on.
Yeah. You wrote about this. People can check out your piece about Dupont. I don't think he's doing anything necessarily which is out of the ordinary or revolutionary, but it is interesting to see the type of things that teams like France are doing. So, you know, sleep patterns are obviously crucial. And you mentioned, depending on the exact temperature outside, that will dictate the exact temperature of the water they have to drink. The hotter it is outside, the cooler the water, obviously. And then, you know, I guess it just shows as much as anything the level to which players are micromanaged and they take as much decision making out of the players' hands as possible. So, you know, he's marked the foods: energy foods, rice, pasta, muesli; protection foods are like vegetables, dark chocolate, dried fruits; or construction foods, which are proteins, chicken, turkey and eggs. And you said, after a long training session, the players have to have two foods from each category. After short sessions, they have to have two from protection and one from energy. It's really prescribed down to the last morsel.
Yeah, it is, exactly. It's very much the it's the Pep, you know, it's the Pep philosophy. Guardiola has a very similar thing going on at Man City, and he had it before at Barcelona as well, and at Bayern Munich. And I think a lot of managers don't realize how important all those things are. And okay, we see it with national teams, you know, the things. And you said it's not revolutionary. What I meant by that is, like, not, you know, not every team does it. For example, even at a club level. And you know, you still see a lot of players coming out after the game, you know, in the Champions League or something, with pizzas or with sandwiches. Yeah. And Dupont, for example, is completely against those kind of things, even after a match. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done on that level, on what players eat before, after matches. You know, they like day minus one before the match, day minus two before the match as well. And I think on that, he's spot on. And, you know, it's too early to say, you know, if that has had a positive impact on the team and the players or not. But you would think that it can't do any harm anyway. And that you would think, you know, it would be positive.
Yeah, even placebo effect, if nothing else, might kick in. So, Julian, thanks for all your time. We'll let you get to sleep in Moscow and get tucked up in bed. And we'll see how France go tomorrow.
Thank you, guys. Anytime, you know.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Julian Laurent there, whose work is brilliant and well worth reading. And the doctor he's talking about, that DuPont article, I'll give you the website it's on, or where Julian's done that, because he's written in a few different places. But the doctor, Gregory DuPont, France. I'm sure if you Google that and Julian Laurent's name, you'll get the article. Lots of interesting bits in it. Again, I don't think any of it's revolutionary. And you're always wary in the post-marginal gains era to get too caught up in this. But it's an insight anyway. He's got this 14-page document, DuPont, for the team. We'll take a short break. Raphael Honigstein will tell us about what's going on with Germany. So the French had a big meeting with Deschamps on Monday, and it seems the Germans, according to Manuel Neuer, had their most explosive meeting in quite some time as well.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Welcome back. So Julian Laurent there was telling us about the meeting that the French had with Deschamps, where they told him, frankly, they didn't know what the hell they were supposed to be doing. It seems the Germans have had a meeting of their own. Let's go to Raphael Honigstein, who joins us from, where are you, Raphael?
I'm in Moscow.
Everyone's in Moscow. So is Julian Laurent. Have you seen Julian?
I have seen him, but that was before the first France game, so I think he was in a better mood then.
Well, he's tucked up in bed now, is Julian. Thank you for staying up late. The reports we're getting from everyone on Moscow are good. Julian's raving about the metro, likes the general layout of the city, and the people are warm. And I'm kind of pretty much struggling to think of a negative thing we've had from the various contributors in the show thus far.
Yeah, no, I think if you're working here as a Western journalist or foreign journalist, full stop, you're having a good time. You are. Everything is easy, it's well organized, the food is really good, it's fairly cheap to get around. But I think you also realize that you're in a privileged position, because you come back and you don't have to be afraid of what you're writing and how investigating, and you're not an opposition politician. So it is not really the full picture that you're getting here.
No, but they're organizing the tournament, I guess, is the point. So Mexico's win against Germany, how bad were Germany, in your opinion? You're watching them through the last number of years, you're watching this group, you're watching Yogi Love. Where did this rank in terms of German performances?
I think when you're talking about a tournament performance, this was as bad as it got over those 14 years he's been in charge, or 12 when you start from 2008. I think, oversaw a game where Germany in the first half completely fell apart. Could not react. They had prepared for a different kind of game. They had prepared for a Mexico team that were going to press high and keep the ball, and Mexico did the exact opposite, press deep, and then went straight for their throat.
Yeah.
And they couldn't react. They couldn't react during the game. By the time they sort of regained a bit of the control and a bit of organization, they couldn't break them down. And Musk rank as one of the really poorest performances. I think if it was just a one game, you wouldn't have had such a big fallout. But because you've had these two friendlies where Germany had shown almost the same kind of problems when it comes to lack of organization, cohesion, no cutting edge in the final third, really slow to get back.
Mm.
Then everyone got a little bit scared and concerned because they were saying, you know, we talked about this before. We thought we'd had to address these issues. We thought that come the World Cup, we're going to be fine, but we were not. So we have to sit down because just carrying on and believing that everything's going to turn out was not an issue. That's why there's this really lengthy meeting.
Meeting. Okay, interesting. So this is more of a trend maybe. And so Manuel Neuer was saying it was a wake-up call. There's never been such strong words within the team about this meeting. Do we have any details? Do we know who spoke the most? Was this a criticism of Yogi Love to Yogi Love, or was he very much involved? What do we know?
No, the coaching staff are part of it. What we do know is, I think, compared to what used to be said in the 80s and 90s, the team meetings were still relatively mild and non-personal. This was about tactics. This was about, you know, the issue at hand. It didn't get personal as far as I know, as I've heard. But of course, you cannot always neatly separate these things. For example, when it comes to the position of Sami Khedira, he's supposed to be the holding midfielder, but he's also the box-to-box player that isn't really a number six behind him. Now, if he hasn't got the legs anymore at 31 to do the job, is it good enough to just say, you know what, maybe he'll do it better next time? Or does Lewis have to see that and think, okay, at least either I need a guy behind him to help him, or I need somebody else? So I think there are very different opinion on this. Football is no similar to any other sort of corporate endeavor that, you know, different people have different opinions and different agendas. Lewis has to juggle all these things and come up with a solution. But I think what is clear is that Germany cannot expect simply to do the same thing again with a better result, because right now the setup isn't solid enough to deal with these weaknesses that they have.
And do they have pretty good options?
They have lots of options. They have Ilkay Gundogan, who, of course, is not a defensive midfielder, but can certainly help Germany with the circulation, with keeping the ball really well with his positioning. You have Leon Goretzka, who's a really young and up-and-coming box-to-box player who had a great time already in Russia at the Confed Cup, where they won with a very young team. So these guys, as you can imagine, the guys who came here last year and won, are kind of saying, give us a chance, you know, why are you sticking with these old guys?
Yeah.
Of course, they have to be very careful how to express it. There's Sebastian Rudy, who's sort of a deep-lying playmaker. He's not really physical, but he's very good at keeping the ball as well. And there's Matthias Ginter, who's kind of an out-and-out holding midfielder, who can also play in some of those defensive positions. So there are options. But Neuer, interesting, was making the point that the commitment and the desire to actually come back and help out wasn't there. So he was saying, not so much in his view, tactics are wrong. He was saying that the application was wrong. And of course, that just adds another sort of dimension of complexity, because Lewis has to figure out, you know, are these guys who've already won the World Cup, are they as committed, are they as hungry to work for the team as the guys who are perhaps coming in and have it all to do for the first time around?
As is the case with his career at club level, Mesut Ozil can often be a lightning rod for criticism when things aren't going well. Stefan Effenberg wants him to be dropped, wants Marco Reus in there. I could not understand that Reus did not play against Mexico. And then I thought Lothar Matthäus' piece was fairly hard-hitting as well. His body language is negative. He's in the game without joy. I often have the feeling on the pitch that Ozil doesn't feel comfortable in the German jersey. He's not free. It's almost as if he doesn't want to play. There's no heart, there's no joy, there's no passion. For a year or two he's played at that level. He does not justify the free ticket of Yogi Love. And then he also added, what I observed after the anthem in Moscow made me very angry. 10 German players waved into the audience, giving the fans a sign. Only Ozil didn't. This makes it obvious to me he doesn't understand why there are such great discussions in Germany about him. He is unaware of what people in Germany expect from a national player. I wondered what that was. There an underlying criticism of Ozil's ethnic background and his lack of understanding of what it means to be German and German, you know, and he's representing the Germans? Quite possibly not. But that point about, you know, no heart, no passion, There is something in Ozil's performances or body languages or demeanour which tends to draw that type of criticism.
Yes, because I think it's an easy way to get at him. And this is not something that will come as a huge shock to Arsenal fans who've had similar discussions, of course, in the past. Ozil exudes that kind of vibe and things don't work for him or for the team. He does, his shoulders do drop and he does seem a little bit lost. I don't personally think that he was the issue. I think Germany had other problems. I think he was one of the few players who actually had a pretty decent game. Of course, he wasn't at his usual standard, but then it was difficult because everybody else was having a stinker. But this is what Matthias is saying, what Effenberg is saying, and these are guys, you know, who did all sorts of really horrible stuff in their days as players. I mean, Effenberg was sent home from the World Cup showing the middle finger to German fans. So, you know, it's a little bit disingenuous, I think, that he now would, you know, decide how an international player has to perform best, because he certainly didn't. But putting all that aside, of course, there is the issue with the Erdogan meeting and with this slight disaffection, I think, that some sections of the German public have towards Özil because of what happened.
This was just repeat, you didn't catch this, he met with the Turkish president recently.
Yes, he met with the Turkish president in London, and him and Ilkay Gündoğan presented them with signed shirts. Ilkay Gündoğan's shirt said, "Oh, my president." And this is a guy who repeatedly refers to the German government as Nazis, who's imprisoned German politicians, who's imprisoned 50,000 of his own people. And because there's a huge Turkish community in Germany, this is a much more sort of immediate impact on German public life than if it was, let's say, the Nigerian president or, you know, some despot in the Middle East. This is a guy who's next door, and he's seen as somebody who's really not a friend of Germany. So it was a very complex, very complicated, and very problematic meeting. And I think it encouraged those who maybe like Matthias, maybe like Effenberg, who always felt that these guys are not fully German.
Yeah.
But there's a football thing, and that's slightly disconnected. There is this, I think, this sense that, as you know, if you follow the Premier League, that people don't like players who don't sweat, who don't bleed, who don't, you know, run and rush into tackles. And Ozil's never going to do that. And unless he produces, that is the way that people will attack him, and that's not going to change.
A Terry Butcher bandage might do the trick if he could engineer that somehow and play through the pain. So, and what about Yogi Love? Because we had Keith Andrews in here co-hosting the football show last night, and he's doing some punditry with Didi Haman at the moment. And he was asking Haman about Yogi Love and where he stands in terms of criticism or pressure, and certainly Didi Haman's view is that Love has so much credit in the bank that he's about a billion miles away from real pressure. Is that the case? Is that how you see it too?
I mean, it depends how you define the pressure. He's under pressure anyway, because people think, you know, they've won the World Cup, and anything but winning the World Cup again is a sense of failure. But I don't think he necessarily really cares about that so much. I think he is not in danger of losing his job, if you know what, you know, talk about pressure and job in terms of job security.
Yeah.
But of course, nobody wants to go home from the World Cup early. That's never happened for Germany, you know, to go home after the group stage since the modern format was introduced. So it would be a huge disappointment, an embarrassment, really. But nobody wants that. But he's won the World Cup, and he's never not finished below the semi-final stage. So
yeah,
even if they were to have a terrible season, I think there is no one really within the FA who's going to put the finger of blame to him.
Okay.
I think the players would get most of the criticism.
Okay. All that said, and everything that's gone on thus far in the Mexico performance, you still kind of fancy Germany to sort this out, I would think, and to reach something very much approaching the semi-finals finally.
Well, one would hope that they cannot possibly play as badly again, and that also Sweden, who are big, strong, were fairly slow, will not pose the same kind of issue. Sweden will be as deep, if not deeper, than Mexico, but cannot, I think, have quite the legs and the ability to pose as many problems on the counterattack. And South Korea are not the greatest side. So really, Germany should do it, but of course Russia comes into it. You know, if it's 0-0 or Sweden somehow score the first goal, then you will get players in their mind thinking, you know, what is going on here? Are we going home? And I think that might pose a real test for the mentality, something that this team has not experienced. Of course, they're all making the point in 2010 they had to win the last game, at least get a point against Ghana. 2014, they needed at least a point against the US. So they've been in pressurized situations, but not in such negativity. So I think they're trying now, listening to Müller today is very impressive in the press conference, they're trying now to kind of reframe the issue and say, okay, we know our mistakes, we know what to do, but let's not forget who we are, let's not forget that we are tremendously gifted, strong, powerful team that have real quality, and let's make sure that we reconnect with who we are. And I would still back them, but I'm less confident, obviously, as I was a few days ago.
Okay. Be interesting on Saturday against Sweden. Rafa, thanks for all that. Cheers.
I remember lying back, pillows on me bed late after, looking at the top of my wardrobe, stacked with boxes of Morro bars. Batch Love, not the heels. And butter's another thing. Over the last couple of years, I've gone back, because I wouldn't have tasted butter for about 15, 20 years. Yeah, bread. Bread was a big thing for me when I went over to England. I missed it. Vienna rolls.
Toast.
Rings of pudding used to, sausages. My ma used to, they used to be packed in the luggage compartment on a.
Surely they did sausages.
Would have been right there.
English sausages would
have been. No, they're Irish recipe. They're Irish recipe, which is a nowhere near, is it?
I've had sausages of, Grim Stag Weekend over in the UK, and they tasted okay, no?
If they're sausages in a Grim Stag Weekend, Joe. You want to be able to savour the sausage.
Might bring back the batch, cut a big heel, open up, eat the heel, flip it over, go for the heel down the bottom, wrap it back up again, flip it back over, put it back in the bread bin so nobody's aware of it until they dug down right at the end. Although there's something nice about toast, putting the butter, if a cold slab of butter on top and just watching it walk its way across the toast slowly.
So true.
As God intended. No, just Vienna, it's that fresh bread, not going to the Super Queen, the bread coming out. Breathe it in.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.